Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and I'd like to welcome my great guest co-host today, Dr. Jonathan Waldman. Welcome, Jonathan.
Thank you so much for having me.
You know, it's great to always have one of our resident learners here. Your enthusiasm, your excitement, your knowledge, share with your health listeners.
Thank you. It's great to be here. It's great to be able to share what we're learning with everyone out there.
Well, you know, on our show today, we're going to be talking with Dr. James Salas, Distinguished Professor and Chief of the Division of Behavioral Medicine at the University of California, San Diego, about his research into the impact of urban design on our health. A really fascinating topic. I'm looking forward to that conversation.
Me too. It's something that I think is becoming, you know, more prominent these days, and it's really interesting to delve more into.
But first, we've got some really interesting research that matters on pets and helping people manage mental illness. Let's first disclose. Do you got a pet?
I don't. I wish.
We've got two dogs, and I must say, I am amazed at the majority of people who are dog lovers, but particularly when I bring the dogs around to come visit someone who may be elderly who likes dogs, they love the interaction, and the dogs seem to love interacting. It's really something special.
Absolutely. And we see it all the time in the hospital when we have care animals that come in and see patients and help cheer them up, and I think it really makes a big impact.
Yeah, well, this was actually some research that was in the journal BMC Psychiatry, British Medical, and it's looking at research on doing interviews with people. There were 54 people that they were interviewing, all of whom had long-term mental illnesses, and sharing kind of their reactions of how pets help them with their mental illness. Tell us a little bit more about this.
Yeah, so they talked with a number of people, including people with severe mental illness, so schizophrenia, bipolar. And what was interesting is that many of these people said that it was their pets who helped them manage the condition most.
Yeah, that's initially kind of surprising. We would think, you know, as doctors, well, it's the drugs and, you know, the family support, which are all important. But they actually had these people with serious mental health kind of did circles. And they said to what extent the pets were really a major part of the social circle. And then 60% said they were as much as close family and social works, and 20% put pets in the second circle. I thought that was really important, but then their comments, I think, were really, really important. I think one person said, you know, pets don't look at the scars that you have. They don't question where you've been. One person who had birds in particular started talking about, they help me in the sense that I'm not thinking about voices. I'm just hearing the birds singing. I love that.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. And I think that it speaks to the importance of social interactions and support in mental illness, and having someone who is an unconditional level of support from their pets is absolutely important in these people's lives.
One last thing. It seemed to have a presence of a pet may even have a protective effect, that some people who were perhaps suicidal, which is always a difficult issue and stress of medical and mental health can contribute to it. But when they had a pet, they were less likely to think about that because there was someone else to care for. So there's real positive benefits. I think it's become part of our standard kind of either counseling or asking about or learning from in the conversation we have with patients with mental illness.
Mm-hmm. And potentially recommendations as well to encourage people to have pets to support them and give them structure and importance in their life as well.
Sounds good to me. Let's talk about our next research that matters, John, that also I think is a really good piece of research, the design of packages. I mean, do you ever get a prescription and you're sitting there trying to read the small print on a package that comes to you? I don't know if that ever happened to you.
Absolutely. And I think even more so in over-the-counter medications.
We get them and they look different. I mean, you're looking for the information frequently of how to give a prescription or how to tell people how to take it. And like you're looking for the fine print. Where does it say how often I should take it? Or where does it say what's actually in the medicine? And I find myself frequently it's like it's not easy to find.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely.
What about this research? What are they looking at?
So they were looking at over-the-counter medications and seeing if they could make changes in the labeling to help prevent overdoses. And so they made changes to the text size, the placement of the text, and the color scheme within it. And what they did is they asked participants to look at the labeling and within 3 seconds mention whether it included a specific medication. And they noticed that different changes just in the text size and the layout really could make a big impact in their awareness of what's in medications.
Yeah, I found this really fascinating, is that these types of changes can be like noticed real quickly, like putting what you need to see on a big font with a nice color background so that you focus on what you need to see and less focus on what you don't need to see. Like they said, the brand name perhaps isn't quite as important as what's the drug inside this brand name. And, you know, the brand name is really, really big. In their experiment, there were significantly less errors that were made by people who were seeing these revised packages, right?
Mm-hmm. And these errors can make a big impact on someone's lives. I mean, especially things like Tylenol, which we see is put in so many medications these days, that to be able to identify that it's in certain things like cough medications and things like that is really important.
Yeah. At the very least, this is something to be hopeful for and to look forward. At the very worst, let's look at the packages that we're currently taking. Maybe have people pull them out when they come in to see us as doctors and kind of say, there are some human factors, which is the name of the journal this article was in, pun intended, that we can really improve upon.
Absolutely.
Let's talk about our next research that matters, John. And this is about the problems that we sometimes see with hyped articles in journals. And I'm really sensitive to this because, you know, we see and we report on research that matters and, you know, how one reports on an article that comes out and it finds a major study. But then it seems like a couple of years later, a different article comes out that kind of refutes that study. And it's like, well, did we jump on the bandwagon when it came out? And then we jump off the bandwagon and then our patient's confused. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that, you know, one of the dangerous things about health media is that a lot of times the nuance that's in scientific literature and the limitations of that literature just doesn't come out in a lot of the lay press. And so it's important that we're paying attention to those things and having a critical mind when we look at news.
Yeah, this was actually in the journal called EMBO Reports. And they really suggest, I think, something kind of appropriate, which is that we probably shouldn't pay too much attention to a single study, but we should pay more attention to these studies that we call systematic reviews, these compilation of large groups of studies, because that is unlikely to lead us astray, and perhaps just be a little more skeptical about any single study. That doesn't mean that it may not be true, but, you know, if the effect is small, maybe we should be a little more careful, cautious. I don't know what you think.
No, absolutely, and I think we talk a lot about these days, a lot of times just reading headlines and not getting into the articles. But I think even going a step further and doing more research, talking to your doctor, talking to other people, and trying to get the full story behind the headlines that we see.
And is this reproducible? Is this the first study, the second study, third study? You know, the third studies may be more important because that's the reproducibility that makes a difference.
And not only which study, but how well was that study done?
Yeah. Well, let's talk about our last research that matters, John. And this is about apps for STI, sexually transmitted illnesses. Not something I would have thought about, but how often are these apps accurate?
So it looks like they looked at a number of apps. It looks like there's about 90 mobile apps that have information about sexually transmitted infections, and they found that in about a third of these apps, there were inaccurate information.
Yeah, this was research that they looked at from the University College of London. And they looked on Google Play and iTunes and found actually what I found kind of surprising, that only 13 apps were fully accurate, 46 were mostly accurate, and 28 were actually only partially accurate. So the real question is, what types of information are these apps putting out there that may lead people astray? Do you have any examples of things they found?
So it lists a number of things, including one part that speaks about certain medicinal herbs, which may be beneficial in creating a strong immune system against HSV. Another part that says that getting treatment for genital warts may cause a very bad time and will shatter your relationships.
Yeah, those things not so medically indicated and not things that we would be recommending.
Absolutely. But I think that it's interesting that it looks like there are a number of people who are trying to get information about these infections, and it speaks to the need for apps that do provide accurate information.
One of the things I really liked is that does the app actually have footnotes? Does it reference the information that's being out there? Well, that'll conclude the Research That Matters portion of our show. We're going to take a short break, and when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. James Salas, Professor-in-Chief of the Division of Behavioral Medicine at the University of California, San Diego, about the critical impact of urban design and your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein, Dr. Jonathan Waldman. We'll be right back.
UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jonathan Waldman. Today on Conversations, Jonathan, we're talking with Dr. James Salas, Distinguished Professor and Chief of the Division of Behavioral Medicine at the University of California, San Diego, and Program Director of Active Living Research, about the critical impact of urban design on your health. Welcome, Dr. Salas.
Thank you.
This is such an interesting topic, and I know it's one that John and I are really interested in exploring. But I think first off, we'd like to know, how did you get interested in urban design?
Well, I can assure you it was not a straight path. My training is in psychology, where I was taught nothing about the environment. But I got interested in health very early in my career, decided that I would focus on physical activity in the early 80s when that was the middle of the fitness revolution, which I would say has not really revolutionized our society, but there was a revolution, at least in consciousness, about, hey, this is something I should be doing. So I started doing what psychologists do, developing programs to educate and motivate people to be active. And some of them worked pretty well, some of them didn't, and that was pretty discouraging. But I had one experience that really put me on the path to looking into, well, what is going on in our environments. When I first came to San Diego, I was part of a grant, and we were going to educate families with children how to eat better and be more active. And we were recruiting all these children from low-income areas around San Diego. And so I thought, well, maybe I should look at the neighborhoods just to see what we can find. So we compiled a list of about 75 examples of healthy foods of the kinds we would be recommending. And we went to look at the food stores in the neighborhoods. And one of the first things we found out is that where are the supermarkets? So I think we were one of the first people to find out about food deserts. And so not surprisingly, the convenience stores and liquor stores in these low-income neighborhoods had virtually none of the healthy foods that we were recommending. And as we looked farther around the neighborhoods, we saw that many neighborhoods had parks, but a lot of those parks were pretty run down. There wasn't much to do in them. There wasn't much programming. And a lot of streets didn't have sidewalks, and they had unsafe street crossings. So I started thinking to myself, how is our educational program going to be effective when, if I was a parent, I wouldn't let my kid go out and play unescorted here, and there clearly is not healthy food available that we're going to be recommending. We had a wonderfully theoretically based program that didn't really have much effect. So that was a revelation to me that it's pointless to motivate people to do things that their environment is going to prevent them from doing. So that eventually led me to try to create healthy schools and then undertake the much more difficult topic of how do we make healthy cities. And so that's what I've been working on for the past 15 years.
Fascinating.
Yeah, and that takes us to the idea of something called the built environment. If you could just talk a little bit about what that term means and the impact of the built environment on people's health.
Yeah, this is a term that has been taken more from city planners, and it really describes everything that we do to create environments around us, buildings, roads, parks, that sort of thing. So the places where we spend almost all our time, unless we go out in nature, we're pretty much in the built environment. So it's a very broad term. And there's been an explosion of research on the relation of built environments to health over the past about 15 years. And there's a couple of summary statements that have come out of it. One is that your zip code is more important to your health than your genetic code. And the other is we need to create environments that make the healthy choice the easy choice. So people in different zip codes with different social environments, different socioeconomic status, and different built environments can in the same city can have a range of, you know, 10, 15, even 20 years in life expectancy. And we're showing that the built environment is related to physical activity, it's related to risk of obesity, it's related to risk of becoming diabetic. The evidence just continues to grow. But I've been focusing on the role of the built environment and physical activity myself.
I just came back from Europe and being in the city of Amsterdam and making sure that if I didn't not only just look to my left and right for cars, but more importantly, look to my left and right for bicyclists and walkers, I would have been hit and probably killed by a bicyclist because the number of people biking, and I'm told there were millions of bike, more so than the number of population. Talk to us about what it means to be a smart city today. What does that mean, and how does that relate to these built environments?
Well, it relates dramatically. And yes, being in Amsterdam is kind of like being on a different planet than being in the United States. And I was just involved in a special series of papers in The Lancet on urban design, transport, and health. And comparing a normal American city to a place like Amsterdam is quite instructive. The idea, you know, what this series of papers showed is that we're learning a lot about how to create healthy environments, healthy cities, active cities, and actually active cities appears to be the key. Because if you design your city to support active transportation, that is, transportation that does not depend on private cars, then you achieve very many health benefits. Probably the biggest health benefit is more physical activity and thus less chronic disease, but you also take cars off the road or reduce use of cars, which reduces pollution, which in turn reduces risk of lung disease. Cars off the road or cars going slower is safer for pedestrians and bicyclists, so you reduce injuries. So there's a really wide range of health benefits you get when you create an active city. And there's really, I think, two big categories of strategies to create an active, healthy city. One is to design compact, mixed-use, and denser cities. And so Amsterdam is a really great example of that. Virtually every old city is compact, dense, and mixed use, or what we would refer to as a walkable city. New York is probably the best example in the United States. Manhattan is the most walkable, the most active, and the least obese place in the U.S., not coincidentally. But the same principles apply all over the world. Walkable city means that a lot of the places you need to go are within walking distance. But that's not how we build cities in the U.S. We build them so that we have residential subdivisions in one place, we have shopping centers in another place, we have schools somewhere else, and we have office parks for people to work elsewhere, so that they're all too far to walk to, so people have to drive everywhere. So the second strategy related to walkable cities or active cities or not is the transportation system. And in the U.S., we've been working for the past 50 or 60 years toward the transportation goal of moving as many cars as fast as possible. That has been the priority, and so we have built a system that prioritizes cars and deprioritizes everything else. So that's why we have so many cities without sidewalks. That's why there are so few bike facilities, because the transportation goals don't say to move bikes, they move cars. So we put all our money into cars. And so then people don't have realistic options or safe options for walking and biking.
We need to take a short break. When we return, we'll continue talking with our guest, Dr. James Salas, Distinguished Professor and Chief of the Division of Behavioral Medicine at the University of California, San Diego, and Program Director of Active Living Research, about the critical impact of urban design can have on our health.
Your health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jonathan Waldman. We've been talking with Dr. James Salas, Distinguished Professor and Chief of the Division of Behavioral Medicine at the University of California, San Diego, about urban design and health. One of the examples I think I've heard you talk about in some of your work is Atlanta, Georgia, my hometown where I grew up, and one of the greatest places of problems in traffic. And oh my gosh, people talk about they drive an hour each way to work and sometimes never see their friends 2 or 3 miles away because of how long it takes. How did you get interested in Atlanta?
Well, just on a personal note, I grew up in the South, too, in Jackson, Mississippi, which I guess is a tiny version of the epic sprawl of Atlanta. Atlanta is famous for, I think it goes into, the sprawl region goes into like 13 counties, so it's just huge. So people are just driving outrageous amounts of time, and my guess is that's those commutes are not the highlight of those people's day. But one of the things that we see in Atlanta and elsewhere is that people want options. Most people don't really want to live in sprawl. And it was very clear in the economic crisis starting in 2008 that houses in the suburbs or property in the suburbs declined in value much more than walkable neighborhoods, because in walkable neighborhoods, well, you don't have to drive. If you were having financial problems, you could sell your car and still get around. But in the suburbs, you can't do that. So even in Atlanta, there is movement towards, I think, in my opinion, saner and healthier planning. And just one example, people may not know about the Beltline around the city that is converting an old rail track to a beautiful walking, biking path that's connecting many parts of the city and leading to economic revitalization along it. So that's an interesting strategy, creating healthier places for economic development.
Now you've got
economic development as a side effect of healthier design.
You've got audio clip from some work you're doing in Atlanta. I wonder if you could just tell us what we're listening to and why this is important.
Okay. Well, let's play it now.
What are we listening to? Tell us what we're listening to and how this came about.
Okay, this is an exciting project in Atlanta and many other places. This is called an Open Streets, and an Open Streets event where they close down streets to traffic on Sunday and open it to people walking, biking, skateboarding, skating, riding their tricycles, whatever they want to do. I think in Atlanta it's called Streets Alive, which is a great name. They do it periodically, as do dozens of cities across the U.S. It's a big party. One of the best descriptions I've heard is it's miles of smiles, because people are just taking over the street for people, not cars. So it changes the way people think about how you can use streets. People used to have control of the streets, and I learned from reading Smithsonian Magazine, that transition from people owning the streets to cars owning the streets, one of the steps in that process was the creation of a crime called jaywalking. And when cars first started coming out, got a bad reputation because the cars were killing people. They were running over people and killing them. And so the car maker said, well, the way to solve that is to get the people out of the streets. So let's make that a crime and let's call it jaywalking. And at that time, at the beginning of the 20th century, jay meant, you know, a pejorative for somebody who wasn't very, very sharp. And so that's how jaywalking got started. And now, you know, people think of jaywalking as a crime and that people have no rights to the streets. So maybe it's time for a little change of mindset as well as a change of laws. And these open streets events give people an experience of being in the street without cars. And it's fantastic. It's just a giant party.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. And reading through some of your research, you were talking about the change that people make in the level of BMI that they decrease or increase, whether they change from how they commute to work. But the other thing that came out in your research was just showing how few people actually switch from either actively commuting to more passively commuting. And I was just wondering what your thoughts are on ways that individuals, maybe our listeners or other people, could either change their own habits or that they could influence their communities to change the habits of that environment.
Yes, a great question. I would certainly encourage people to look for opportunities to integrate more walking and bicycling into their lives. And if they can replace a car trip with a walking or biking trip to pick up a few groceries or, you know, go have a cup of coffee, meet a friend, then they're both cutting down pollution, making their streets safer, and improving their health through physical activity. If it was safe for you to ride your bike, let's say 20 minutes to work every day, well, you've just done your 30 minutes of physical activity for that day without, you know, having to schedule that in. So it's a really efficient way to get your activity through active transportation. On a community level, I would encourage everybody, and including maybe especially health professionals, to get involved in advocating for healthier communities. I tell physicians and nurses often, you can have a bigger impact on health in your community outside your clinic than you can inside the clinic. Because if you advocate for a new park in a low-income neighborhood, for regular physical education in schools, for a change in zoning to favor or require mixed-use zoning where every resident can realistically walk for errands, then you're going to have an effect on thousands of people over many years. We need more people speaking up for policy changes that are going to result in healthy communities, because every built environment change is opposed by someone. And some should be opposed and some should be supported, depending on the benefit to the community, and certainly the health benefit should be high on the priority list.
As we're wrapping up, if you could leave our Your Health listeners with one final thought, what would it be?
I would say go learn about healthy community design and then become an advocate among your colleagues and in your community. Become a leader for healthy communities. Everybody can do it.
Well, we appreciate what you're doing and your research and your leadership. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your interest in this topic.
We've been talking with Dr. James Salas, Distinguished Professor and Chief of the Division of Behavioral Medicine at the University of California, San Diego, and Program Director of Active Learning Research, about the critical impact urban design can have on our health.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Jonathan Waldman. We'll be right back.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Calls segment of our show today, John and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, you can send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu. And we'd like to ask our great executive producer, Laura Lacey, to read us our very first house call question today about head lice.
Yesterday, we got the dreaded call from my daughter's school, lice. What do we do? Are lice associated with any serious health risks?
I can tell you, having had kids, and I wouldn't say that my kids were immune. Even being a doctor's kids, you can be exposed to head lice and get head lice. It's crazy scary, and it's not fun at all.
Yeah, I mean, I think that even us in the medical profession, sometimes we see lice as kind of a boogeyman of something that, we get scared about. So it's something that's really important.
And not always is the person who's affected by the head lice going to have symptoms. So sometimes you may have a classmate affected and you may not know that you have them. And so sometimes, like when kids come into a camp environment, sometimes we do kind of – we look at the kids and do a quick assessment of kids, a head lice check, because we want to prevent the spread, epidemic spread of head lice.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the interesting things is that the itching that you get with head lice is not actually from the lice, but it's from an immune response to the lice. And so some people, when they get it for the first time, it takes a while for them to start having itching symptoms.
And just having those eggs of the head lice, those nips in the hair, does not mean that someone actually has an active infestation. That may mean that they were exposed and it could be in the past. But the key is to try to get those nits out of there. And that's where they have these nit combs, where you can try to decrease and treat these things potentially without medication. So a lot of times medications are going to be needed.
Yeah, and I think it, you know, depends on a person-by-person basis of what you feel most comfortable with. For some people, they want to avoid using the medications, and so the nit combs can be really helpful. The thing about that is that nit combing can take a while. It can take 15, 30 minutes per time that you do it. And so for some people, they prefer to use the medications. But it depends on what each person is most comfortable with.
And there's really a whole host of treatments that are available. And one of the big concerns is that there is more resistance to some of the things that people might have heard of in the past. And so you really have to really work, I think, to get them treated. The CDC, Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has some really good guidelines. And there's, again, a variety of different medications, topical medications. There is oral medication that's available in some circumstances that may be indicated. And you really have to look at what's the cost of the medicine, what's the safety of the medicine, what's the ease of administration of the medicine. These are things that – but most people, they'll take one of the topical medicines.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that that's what we're all most comfortable with. And I think the other part on top of treating it is preventing it from being spread to other people. And so certainly we know that it's spread from touch, so from person to person. But the other thing is making sure that those things that touch hair get treated as well. And so we definitely recommend washing clothes, bedding, all those things in really warm water and also drying on a really warm cycle as well. And if there's things that come in contact that can't actually be washed, what we recommend is you put those things in a bag sealed tight for 2 weeks to make sure that, that gets treated.
Great idea, John. And last thing I would just say is that if you have another child that's sharing a bed with someone infected, that child does need to be treated. But if a child does have lice, they don't have to be excluded from school. They're treated. They can actually go back into a school environment. So don't be so alarmed if you see the child or you hear about the child that had lice back in school the next day. As long as they've been treated, it should be just fine. Well, that's a great question. And it will actually ask our health sciences librarians to put up some information about the treatments for lice, because I do think this will be helpful for our listeners.
Absolutely.
Laura, what's our very next house call?
I've recently been considering a Botox treatment for a few fine lines on my face. What's your take on that?
That's a little bit more complicated than it may appear, and you're not alone. A lot of people are interested in Botox. I'm sure you see it occasionally and have heard about it a lot, John.
Absolutely. You know, certainly people come in and they have questions about it. I think just kind of an interesting thing about Botox is understanding what it actually is. And so if you look at the word Botox, so B-O and then tox, which stands for botulinum toxin. And so what it actually is it's the active ingredient in botulism. So you've maybe heard of botulism in the past, which is where people would eat from canned foods that maybe got bad. And it causes a paralysis. And so essentially what you're doing with Botox is that you're injecting that toxin, and it helps to paralyze muscles to, in this case, cause less wrinkles. But we use them in other medical indications as well to paralyze muscles.
Yeah, and there are different forms of this botulinum toxin, but all of them kind of do this same thing. And it is indicated for helping improve these fine wrinkles. The problems is that when it wears off, the wrinkles come back. So you want to just kind of starting a process. It's a continuing process. And then there can be some side effects. What happens if we inject it and it it paralyzes the face.
Oh, yeah, so absolutely. If you get too much of the toxin that goes into other places, you can have trouble with swallowing, breathing, things like that could cause much bigger effects down the line.
And sometimes we see people on TV and you think they're not moving their eyebrows very much. They're not smiling very much. And the problem is they've just gotten their Botox and if you get too much of it. And then there are some side effects. There are increased risk of urinary tract infections, bladder problems. You can have upper respiratory infections. If you're allergic to cow's milk, that's a strong contraindication. So let's not think it's just, oh, this is just something that doesn't have that. You should really talk with your doctor, if it's your family doctor that's doing it, or your dermatologist, internist. Find out what it is that you could possibly have that might work but also might go wrong. Laura, what's our very next house call?
Every few months when I'm really stressed out, I end up with cold sores. They're horrible. Do you have any advice for preventing them and or dealing with them when they pop up?
Well, lice aren't very nice, and cold sores are definitely not good either. These are difficult problems here. I think cold sores is one of those things that almost everyone probably has had at some point in time, at least the terminology cold sores or some sort of ulcer in your mouth. They're probably talking about a particular type of cold sore, one that could be caused by a herpes virus, but maybe not.
And this is a topic that's very near and dear to my heart. I deal with cold sores on and off, and so it's something that I have a lot of experience with. What we typically think of cold sores are caused by the herpes virus. It's a different herpes virus than we typically think of with genital herpes. It's HSV-1. And so they can be a really annoying problem. And the issue with it is that the herpes virus essentially hides within your nerves. So it is really hard to treat because it's hidden there in the nerves and it comes on and off. But there are some things that you can do to help prevent it from happening.
What do you recommend for preventing?
So there's a lot of things that can trigger cold sores to be more common. One of the most common ones is sunlight. So sunburns on your mouth can cause more frequent cold sores. So if you use sunscreen or use chapstick that's got sunscreen in it, that can help decrease that. Other things like illnesses and fevers can also make them more common. So of course, being as healthy as you can and trying to avoid those things. But inevitably, it's going to happen. You're going to get a cold sore. And so when you do, it's important to know what to do when you get them. The most effective thing that they've found is a medication. It's called acyclovir. It's a medication that you need to get from your doctor, but what you can do is you can get a prescription for it, and what you do is you start taking it right when you start to get some sort of indication that it's coming on, whether that's tingling or pain, and that can help decrease the length of that cold sore.
And frequently, this is an oral medication. You could get it topically, but the topically is not usually what people are giving in order to really cut down and cut the virus from replicating. And then if you had these cold sores a lot, like every couple weeks, you might actually be on a preventive therapy to cut down. These are things to talk about to your doctor, I assume.
Absolutely. So once you start getting them more frequently, multiple times a year, then that's the time when we start thinking about taking it more frequently. But if you get it that frequently, I'd talk to your doctor and figure out what the best regimen is for you.
Good information, John. Laura, what's our very last house call?
I found out several years ago that I have thyroid nodules. They are benign, and I work with the doctor to monitor them. But what problems could they eventually cause?
Well, we are glad that they are benign, meaning non-cancerous. Thyroid nodules are not easy, and yet they occur very frequently. What do we do to help figure out which ones could be cancerous versus which ones that are we call benign and perhaps can be monitored?
That's the first thing that we want to make sure when you have a thyroid nodule. Is this something that could be cancerous or not? And so we always do a pretty standard workup when we see thyroid nodules, and it starts with just getting an ultrasound to take a look at it. Depending on what they see in that, sometimes we do a biopsy as well. We think about a number of different kinds of nodules. There's the types that can cause cancer, but even within the benign ones, there's certain things that can come up. So you can get nodules that release thyroid hormone and can cause some problems with that, or you have some that you just kind of monitor and they never cause any problems. So it's important to always keep an eye on them and follow with your doctor.
Yeah, so almost always you'll get an ultrasound of the thyroid, a blood test called a TSH, a thyroid stimulating hormone. You might get a thyroid scan. And you might get what's called an FNA, a fine needle aspiration. These are kind of things that are part of the standard workup of thyroid nodules. Rest assured, most of them are benign, and we're so glad to hear that yours is. Well, that'll conclude the house calls today, and we want to thank all of our listeners today for joining us on Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important. You can send your own stories to yourhealth@unc.edu. You can follow us online at yourhealthradio.org, Twitter, Facebook, iTunes, or search our health app. We'd like to thank the UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our guest today, Dr. James Salas, and I'd like to thank my co-host today, Dr. Jonathan Waldman. On behalf of Your Health, I'm Adam Goldstein.
And I'm John Waldman.
And we'll look forward to talking to you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.